charge in Rome, Italy, we used to refer to a particular soccer move as a chilena. Well, I went back to one of my favorite authors, Eduardo Galeano, and Soccer and Sun and Shadow, wonderful book of his that came out in the late 90s, and he's got a great vignette that finally explains years later why La Chilena was called La Chilena. So here's what Galeano wrote. Ramon Unzaga invented the move, the bicycle kick, on the field of the Chilean port Talcahuana. Body in the air, back to the ground, he shot the ball backwards with a sudden snap of the legs, like the blades of scissors. It was some years later when this acrobatic act came to be called the Chilena. In 1927, when Colo-Colo traveled to Europe and striker David Arellano performed it in Spanish stadiums. Journalists cheered the splendor of this unknown gamble, and they baptized it Chilena, because like strawberries and the cueca, it come from Chile. After several flying goals, Arellano died that year, in the stadium at Valladolid, killed in a fatal encounter with a fullback. So that was the story of the Chilena, the great bicycle kick that we attempt and fail, probably for good reason, given that it's so dangerous. But going back to the other word, Pinochet, I knew about Chile because, growing up, somebody had told me that there was a game once played way back in 1973 in a stadium that was virtually empty and only one team took the field, decked out in national colors, red shirt, blue shorts. If we had time, I'd show you the video, it's on YouTube. It was actually the 21st of November 1973 at the Estadio Nacional de Chile in Santiago, which is a big part of the book that Brenda wrote and we'll talk about today. And it was the second leg of a FIFA World Cup qualifying playoff between Chile and the Soviet Union. The first match in Moscow had been played 2 weeks after the coup, and it ended up in a 0-0 draw. The FIFA president at the time was a conservative Englishman named Sir Stanley Rouse, who was sympathetic to the apartheid government, among other things, and he turned down Soviet requests to move the match to a less controversial stadium because, of course, until very recently, remember this is the fall of 73, it was basically an open-air concentration camp and mass torture chamber, the stadium in Santiago. So the Soviets, for various reasons, refused to play at that stadium. The game was not moved to an alternative venue, and the Chilean team took the field, kicked off, and a few seconds later scored the goal that gave them qualification to the 1974 World Cup. So soccer and politics, right from when I was very little, obviously seemed quite inextricably linked, and it's a pleasure to have Brenda Elsie here today to explain exactly the history of that connection between popular culture and politics through the medium of soccer. Brenda is Assistant Professor of History at Hofstra University, and she is the Director of Women's Studies there, as well as the Co-Director of Latin American and Caribbean Studies. She is also a graduate of Michigan State University, one of our very own, with a BA in History, 1997. And I received her PhD, so welcome back, as her PhD from SUNY Stony Brook in 2007. She has taught at New York University as well as SUNY Stony Brook and, of course, at Hofstra. She is the author of The New Citizen and Sportsman, Football and Politics in 20th Century Chile, which is the topic of today's talk. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for coming, and thanks to the History Department and Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, especially Professor Peter Allegi and Alice Galarza for inviting me and arranging my visit here. It is really nice to be back at my alma mater. I'm feeling a lot of memories of my undergraduate days, which I guess means that I feel immature and broke, which isn't that different from the way I normally feel. My talk today centers on my research into the history of football in Chile and its relationship to political practices, attitudes, and organizations. So there's three parts to my talk. The first is that I'll lay out kind of the reason that I chose Chile for my study, the approach that I used in looking at the history of football, and then I'll move on to a background in the history of football and politics in Chile, and including a discussion of the role of ethnic and class identity throughout the 20th century. And finally, I'll examine the conflicts between professionals and amateurs in Chilean football, especially leading up to the World Cup of 1962, which I use as a way to revisit Cold War history and Chile's role in it. So feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions, or if I'm not loud enough, tell me to move to the mic. Can you hear me in the back? Yeah, it's okay? Okay, great. So I'm going to start with just my kind of introduction to the subject, how I approached football, because as you know, throughout the world, football is the most popular sport. Millions of people schedule their lives around it, and yet it's a relatively simple game. It hasn't changed much since its inception in terms of the actual mechanics of the control for a ball. But market forces, globalization, communications technology have fueled its transition now into the mass spectacle that we know. And despite that global appeal, I was really interested in just doing a very local case study, a deeply researched micro history, if you will, of the game, rather than on how it explains the whole world, which I guess it might, but I wasn't ready to embark upon. Previous scholarship that recognized football's importance tended to view the sport as a diversion from class struggle, from party and class politics as a way to integrate young men into state institutions like schools and drive them away from social organization. And I tried to take the opposite track and say, okay, you know, what does football attract sportsmen to, rather than what does it divert them from. And rather than a discursive analysis, I wanted to adopt a relational analysis, or in other words, study civic associations in relation to one another, in relation to practices, and understand how political attitudes were shaped in informal settings, right? So what does soccer have to do with the way that you view the world more, you know, more broadly speaking, especially the way that you view politics, citizenship, who belongs to the nation, and those kinds of questions. And I drew a lot upon Pierre Bourdieu and the idea of culture as practice rather than something out there that exists in sort of an out-of-body set of ideas and values, but rather one established in constant relation to one's practices. So by approaching football as something that really happens rather than something, you know, byproduct of something else, I try to look at Chilean history in a new way. And among the central questions of Chilean history for Latin Americanists is the issue of democracy and civic engagement. So for Latin Americanists for a long time, the idea is that Chile was an enigma for the stability of its state and its democratic tradition. So for my interest, which was in the relationship between popular culture, civic engagement, and politics, it was a really obvious place to study. Right? You have a long trajectory with a stable state, and you can take a look at the ways in which that relationship changes over time, which, right, is what historians do. You know, their bread and butter is still that kind of change over time. And so it was important to me to kind of have that as at the outset as a part of my study. It was also interesting in its position in the Cold War, so that despite an intense campaign by the Kennedy administration to convince Chileans to participate in U.S.'s Alliance for Progress, by 1970, Chile was one of the only places in the world where socialists and communists could hope to be democratically elected, right? So it was very interested in that pluralistic political system that had sort of distinguished itself, certainly by 1970. And it's still a central debate among scholars, right, is how democratic was Chile? So, I mean, not only was it interesting for scholars about its democratic tradition, but then it was interesting to debate, and still is, whether it ever really was, and if it was, how democratic it was, and for whom. And the backdrop of all of this is, of course, its abrupt end, the democratic tradition in 1973, which caused people to relook at the entire century and say, you know what, maybe it wasn't quite where we thought it was, right? And not only that, but it had gone through a process of democratization in the 1990s that South Africa and some other Argentina and other places had done. It was very dissatisfactory for a lot of the activists who had taken part in those transitions. So people rethinking about what democracy was, what does it mean, and it kind of came together with different things in the U.S. that maybe you remember, like the famous book, Bowling Alone, you know, that Robert Putnam, that people in the U.S. And Michigan, by the way, has the most bowling alleys per capita of any place in the world, which probably doesn't shock you if you live here. But anyway, that was the whole idea, that in fact, you know, you used to do things together. What does it mean for democracy when you don't anymore? So I was interested in kind of questions that were going on beyond just Latin America as well. And rather than try to measure the degree of actual democracy in Chile, I was interested in thinking about what believing you were democratic did, right? So rather than sort of looking at Chile and saying, okay, let's see, it's 60% voter turnout and maybe 40% interest and, you know, measuring it in some kind of quantitative way, or even judging what is democracy in a kind of schematic way, I was interested in looking at what that discourse of democracy did and how people used it and how they identified with it or didn't or debated it, right? So now I'll move on to kind of give you a little bit of the background then, if this works, of football in Chile. So, and in Chile begins like it does in Argentina and Brazil and Peru in the 1870s and 80s, brought by British sailors and bankers. But their numbers were always too small to make it a very Anglo tradition. So right away, by the 1890s, clubs had formed in every major port city in Chile, in the mining communities and in the capital, Santiago. And an elite clique of sportsmen began to form larger and more stable organizations by the early 20th century. And today, there's a lot of nostalgia for this era, you know, this pre-market, pure days of when we just went out and played football and there wasn't any commercials or FIFA to worry about. But in fact, people in the early 20th century would not have characterized it that way at all. They saw football, and especially this elite group, as an opportunity to address desperate needs caused by class conflict, industrialization, and urbanization. They thought this was a really terrible time in the city, right? The early 20th century was not at all like this idyllic, you know, running through green fields. This was like a very dirty, industrializing city, one in which workers were starting to claim public space, and that was really threatening to this group of men. So these upper-class patrons then position themselves as benevolent patrons through starting these football clubs for workers. And the way in which they thought about that was very similar to the ways in which they thought about labor unions, right? They've got it wrong. We're really just a fraternity of individuals, and that workers who played for their employers were then entangled in this relationship that was conceived of as voluntary and pleasurable, right? We have this harmonious relationship. And it dovetailed with a series of reform movements that, you know, sort of took off at the beginning of the 20th century, where reformists blamed the workers themselves for the miserable conditions of the city, and elite patrons agreed and said, well, we need to modify their habits, and football becomes part of that. And you can see by, you know, 1920, pretty much in all the schoolyards, you have football teams, you have people trying to use this as a way to convince workers to identify with the nation and their employers rather than one another in a class identity, right? And as an overarching argument in the book, what I've tried to demonstrate is that amateur football clubs, in the end, despite the desires of these upper-class patrons, integrated working men into urban politics, that they connected them to political parties, and they served as venues for political critique. Football clubs were one part, but a very large part, of an emerging network of civic associations that shaped the creation of working-class identity in urban neighborhoods. And that's what the book is really trying to establish. And it sounds easy enough, but it was actually kind of difficult to establish. I brought some sources with me to share. I have some show and tell for later. And basically, another important component of that argument then is that cultural activities of workers organizations, like football, became a central way in which workers claim dignity in the face of, you know, the elite's accusations that they had really bad habits, they were very undisciplined, they didn't have any talent or creativity, and so football becomes one of this really an important venue that underscores their political inclusion, their rights to participate, and in fact not only, you know, tolerating workers, but that in fact maybe they're more creative and more physically fit than the very people who are accusing them of otherwise. And as working class footballers encounter difficulties finding space, they begin to seek the help of politicians. So I'll just give you one example from 1906 of how this relationship comes about. The Democratic and Radical parties are both middle class parties in Chile in the early part of the 20th century. And in June 1906, a group of boys contacted the Democratic Party to protest their treatment by the local military regiment. They said they had begun a football game in Parque Cousiño, which was a public park. They had started this little pickup game, and the military told them to move off of the field. They said, you know, we don't want to move off of the field. And they destroyed all the fruit that they had been selling. So they overturned the carts, they beat them up, and they threatened them with, you know, further beatings if they didn't try to get, you know, if they didn't stop using the field. And so the boys contacted them, and the Democratic Party publicizes their story. It becomes a kind of cute headline. But slowly ties begin to emerge, right? Where, like, well, you know, maybe they start to share the public offices or the offices of the Democratic Party. They start to become entangled in different local political campaigns. And so this kind of, you know, relationship is born in the early 20th century. And the notion that football ought to be democratic and representative of the people was a common theme of the early working class press. And so La Reforma, which is one of these early magazines that's linked to these political parties, frequently advertises stories like this, and finally in the following year gets together an association of working class football teams. And I argue that this is a really important organization because it brings together the working class clubs into an association that's very explicitly trying to disassociate the working class footballers with their bourgeois counterparts, right? And trying very explicitly to say, we don't want to belong to patron, you know, patrone teams anymore, right? This isn't about the patron. This is about us forming our own class identity. So this was an important kind of organization in 1906. And La Reforma then would also be founded with the co-founders of the Socialist Party. So right in the beginning, the left is really active. And I try to discuss in the book a bit, and I don't have too much time, but we can talk about it later, about why the right isn't very interested in organizing football in the same way. They're interested in kind of giving a little seed money and controlling, but they're certainly not interested in these very elaborate clubhouses, which eventually the workers establish, and other activities that the clubs want to participate in. But the left is very actively organizing them. The Workers' Association then took on Santiago Football Association, which was this larger group formed by these clique of elite men, accusing them of segregating the city across class lines, of holding football matches in places that were difficult for workers to get to, of picking only wealthy players that could pay for their passage to different places. So they said, this is really rigged, you're not getting the best players. And they start to do things that they want to circumvent them. So they do different things, like the Football Association has one team that is made up of printers. And so instead of trying to use El Mercurio, which is the kind of mainstream conservative press, they use the printers to get themselves in different papers, a variety of different papers, advertising where the matches were going to be held, sometimes just printing their own leaflets with, like, rules, you know, for clubs so that they didn't have to buy the formal pamphlets that were being distributed by the Santiago Football Association. They do other things, like they have another club, this is Chile Argentina, which is made up of municipal workers. And they send out the municipal workers to kind of look around and see if there are any fields that they can convert into football fields so that they don't have to use the Santiago Football Association's fields. So they use the kind of labor, the skills that their you know, laborers have within the association to try to get around this larger clique of elite patrons, right? And so football, though it's a cross-class space, is not one that's shared in some kind of, you know, romantically harmonious way, as is often remembered today. Now, women, there are a lot of advocates at the time, especially physical education instructors, that debated whether women could play football. So it was good for everybody. Maybe women could do it too. And the feminist paper in 1908 called La Palanca says, you know, laments that women are marginalized from football, that as it becomes important in unions, it also marginalizes women from that space as well. Because if this is the place where unions are having these informal gatherings, this is sort of a double exclusion, right? And as it becomes more important in local politics, it becomes a triple exclusion, if you will. But most people, most men by the 1920s, these clubs aren't really interested in women. In fact, it's a space that's very, part of the attraction is to get away from household duties and to get away from family obligations. And so it's very clear that women are not welcomed at that point. It changes later in the 1950s, and again, we can talk about it. But feminists are very aware that this doesn't do them any service. And then physical education teachers are there to say, you know, it's really harmful. Soccer for the womb, you could get kicked, you could fall down, that it's very dangerous. And so they advocated tennis because it's far away from others. And so you can play tennis, you know, over here, and your womb is safe. And that was the sort of, you know, in the 20s, teens and 20s, that was where they were. Now, I'm going to kind of just scoot through the 20s and 30s to get to the Cold War part, so forgive me, but I will say a few words about that era. The 1920s did see the rise of a military class led by the short-lived dictator Carlos Ibáñez, who comes back later. And the military in the 1920s positioned themselves as technocrats who could modernize Chile and then channel a lot of funds to clubs with ties to the military. Throughout the 1920s then, they used these clubs to crack down on social spaces. And especially, you know, in the stands, like the Barra, the birth of the Barra, people think that the Barra or the fanatics that travel around following clubs is new, right? Like this hooliganism, right, is new. This is very old. This is very, very old. And hooligans in the 1920s, when the dictator is trying to really modernize the city, control social spaces, is really frustrating to Ibáñez. So it's one way in which people, for example, one very common practice in the 20s is their stadiums. And Ibáñez sends out plain-clothed officers. And the fans in the stadium love outing them. So it's like they can tell who they are, and when they do, they kind of put the person up, and people throw stuff, food, and stuff like that. I don't think they actually really hurt them. But they kind of, you know, they throw food, they jeer them, they probably, you know, push them out of the stands and things like that. So a lot of it is about, you know, causing social, any kind of social chaos under Ibáñez was considered to be, it was a very political act because of the terms in which he was in power. And so the 1920s is this kind of fight between a more authoritarian state and practices in these leisure spaces that are absolutely the opposite, right? And so it's a kind of constant struggle. Also, clubs become a guise under which unions operate in the 20s. So we're not a union, we're just a football club. So the idea of kind of using that assumption that sports is apolitical to then be able to continue to meet. And by 1931, at the end of Ibáñez's dictatorship, which was really this one only 4 years, and probably would look a lot worse if we don't have the later one. Now I think people sort of give that one a pass in a sense, but it really shouldn't get one because it's part of an ongoing struggle between authoritarianism and movements for democracy in Chile. But by 1931, amateur clubs were at the forefront of the movement for a return to democracy, and part of what they wanted to do was to build this stadium. So in 1938, they do this after many, many years. And the stadium itself becomes part of the struggle between the people who are pro-Popular Front, which is this multi-party, you probably know them in Europe, right? A kind of coalition between socialists, communists, and middle-centrist parties that arises in the 1930s as a response to fascism. And what they try to do then in the 1930s is use the space, and in the inauguration in 1938, there's actually a huge sportsman march that goes around the whole, you know, the whole stadium. And when the president, who's very conservative, goes to give his speech, he gets completely drowned out by boos. That's Arturo Alessandri, who came back. And people ask why in the 30s, when Argentina and Brazil have this, the beginnings of a relationship with football and politics that takes on a very populist element, why you don't see that in Chile? Like, why you don't see a kind of one party dominating it, or why wasn't Ibáñez able to channel this into support for his, you know, political administration? And what I argue is that by then, the party affiliation is already really strong. It's very hard to develop that kind of personalism when a kind of multi-party state and identity is already in existence for the amount of years. So, like, most of the footballers wouldn't have identified as just being Popular Front, right? Their first sort of identification would be with whatever local party or in, you know, specific party they were a part of. And so, I mean, we could talk about that maybe later, but it's one of the more interesting parts of football in Chile. And so you see a shift where the centrist parties had dominated football in the early part of the 20th century, and by the 1930s and 40s, it was very clear that amateurs were beginning to have closer affiliation with leftist parties in Chile. Professionalism is adopted in the 1930s in Chile, as it is in Argentina and Brazil, though it's not until the 1940s that people have enough money to actually quit their jobs. But an important thing about the social structure is of football clubs is that they're still owned by members. Like, they're still cooperatives, not-for-profit cooperatives, even the professional ones. So it's very different than here, right? I think the only example in the United States would be the Packers, right? Aren't they like that-ish? I don't know. I think it's stipulations, but that would be the sort of closest thing. By the 1940s, then, there are these very elaborate civic organizations. They have statutes, they have headquarters that provide services like telephones, doctors, clinics, restaurants. By the time they integrate women in the 1960s, they've got gynecologists on staff. I mean, you're talking about these really elaborate, huge social organizations that would compete with a lot of state agencies, infrastructure. But the strange thing is that the amateurs find themselves constantly fighting the professionals, and amateurs being composed of, like, the pro-amateur part of the wealthy and the workers, whereas it's mostly middle-class professional teams that are supporting, or middle-class professionals that are supporting professionalism. And so there's a schism that starts in the 40s, and it's a strange ally between these kind of old British elite in Chile that don't want professionalism, they see it dirty, it's all about the British gentleman who plays to play and wouldn't want to demean themselves by taking money. And they're allied with the workers, right? With the different workers' organizations, and it's really the middle class pushing. And David Arellano, actually, who Professor Allegi mentioned in the beginning, in Colo Colo, is the vanguard of professionalism in Chile. And he's a physical education teacher, and along with his other brothers, who are physical education teachers, are part of this. They want, because they think a mass spectacle that people pay for will give them the better products. And that should be what they kind of think of when they think of professional football, is that you're getting a better product. The market delivers, right? And the argument they use, too, is about nationalism in professionalism, that you will develop a good national team. Chile, as you know, probably was really losing badly to Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay, and I should put that in the present tense, or the like that. I was having a terrible time. So there was a big crisis over what you could and how you could overcome this, and they thought professionalism might help. Now, just to show you how disingenuous this is, as soon as professionalism passes, the first thing those club directors do is go to Argentina and Brazil and find as many players as will come, right? So it's not about developing local talent, but that was the argument that was used at the time. Immigrant clubs in Chile were the vanguard of creating spectacles and stadiums. And I argue in the book that they also contributed to the whitened notion of a Chilean mestizo, because it's the Spanish and Italian that present themselves as naturally part of the Chilean national body politic because they're European. And they exclude other groups like the Palestinians, which they have a club now. But then they wouldn't let them in, and they beat them up whenever they played them and tried to kind of push them out of the organization. And most of the time, they're right in line with sports journalism, which also contributed to this idea about Chilean whiteness. And a lot of the ways that they do it in sports journalism is by comparing themselves to their supposedly black neighbors, right? So Peru, Brazil, Uruguay are frequently put in blackface. This is very late. I mean, you may be surprised about how, I don't know, 1952, 1961, you're going to see this is a very common way to portray Brazilians. So here then, right, you've got, with this I can prove that the Brazilian one, and with this I can prove the Chilean one, and it's supposed to be funny because they're the same picture, right? But it's a negative. And this is a really, I could give you, this is one example, but there are hundreds of examples of the ways in which this is done. It's a constant kind of reference all the time of the Chilean as the normative white mestizo, meaning there might have been some Indian there, but it's relegated to the way, way, way past, right? It's ancient, ancianos, and how it's compared to the exaggerated idea of blackness. Especially Brazil, as they become more and more successful, right? We'll come up again and again. So I'm going to move on to the final part of the paper. And in the book, I spent a lot of time on this neighborhood called San Miguel. And I think some of you, we might talk about it tomorrow, if you're around. And how San Miguel is the working class neighborhood in Santiago, in the capital of Chile, that has undergone massive urbanization. And in the process, had also developed a reputation for its labor militancy. So it's metal factories, it's a lot of the vanguard of the working class left in Chile is coming out of San Miguel, and they have socialist politicians. This is Mario Palestro, and I'm sorry it's not a great picture of him, but you can see him right there with the big mustache, right, who will be one of the most prominent socialist legislators beginning in the 1940s as mayor of San Miguel and going through actually until after democratization and Pinochet, where he takes office again. And I use this case to kind of show how the Chilean case is somewhat unique from other models of masculinity like samba or the pistolero in Mexican corridos, in the sense that it's a very politicized football icon. And I won't spend too much time, because I lost some of it, but to say that it's important to understand that the professionals then, going into 1962 and this moment of national attention to Chile, the professionals really capitalize on the effervescence of that icon and the kind of enthusiasm and excitement and energy of clubs, but they do everything they can to depoliticize it and marginalize it. And an important part of that effervescence in amateur football that occurs in the 1950s and early 1960s is the real belief of players that amateurs are better than professionals, that they choose to be amateurs, right? So in interviews and in other kinds of documents, you're going to see people who are you're going to hear people saying, oh, well, I remember the Marti Corena, the Arenas brothers, all of them, they are way better than those professionals. Like, we could win if we just, you know, if we had more support for working class barrio teams, right? And also, it really confounds a lot of other examples where when I was doing interviews, not as successfully as I would like, and when I was reading through what people said, it was really clear that a lot of people were still attending many more amateur games than you would have thought. So that professionalism isn't a natural kind of death to amateurism that we think, right? So that the market just comes in and they're able to kind of sell people on this idea and amateur football is dead. That in fact it lasts a lot longer than one would think. And it also means that Barrio directors have this claim to true democracy in the 1962 World Cup. And professionals and mainstream journalists then base their understanding, so this is the conflict that's going to emerge around 1962, of amateurism and a belief in the interdependence of free market capitalism, individual liberties, and democracies. So what the professionals are arguing, entering into the World Cup, and it's going to be one that's going to go right through Pinochet, right, is the idea that, in fact, to have individual liberty and creativity has to do with freeing up the market, right? So that amateurs' demands for support for their programs, for state subsidies for their programs, are really misguided, right? That professionalism will resolve that, just as free market capitalism does in every other sector. And in the process, they create these really frightening caricatures of the Soviet sports programs. They warn people that if the leftists are elected in Chile, we're all gonna go playing like automatons, and no one will feel free to do La Chilena. We'll all have to be, you know, this kind of robotic team. And so in 1962, what ends up happening, well, I'll just skip because I don't have tons of time. You have 1962, you have these professional directors who look really stressed out, but this is Carlos Dibborn, who kind of engineered this new model of Chile in 1962 that has to do with a belief in the market. For example, I'll just give you one kind of example. It says, this is just one thing. When amateurs accused professionals of exploiting young talent, professionals responded that they misunderstood the market, that poor working class men couldn't possibly understand that, quote, without responsible parties, without anyone proposing things happen this way, it is because the public has preferences. The incredible thing is that amateur directors forget the reasons that determine the state of things, end of quote. So it's always this argument about, you know, they just don't understand, they're just too stupid to understand how wonderful the market is and how if we don't, for example, the amateur said, you know, during the World Cup, you should probably not have price gouging. You should protect hotels. You're going to see this in Brazil really soon, right? You should protect the price of food, you know, so that it doesn't raise up for visitors, and then we end up paying this much more. And professionals are like, you know, there's no reason to do that. Like, the market's going to handle it all, you know? Why would you try to restrict that? And this becomes a fight where they find a lot of sympathy with the Socialist Party and whatnot. So just one sort of last thing, because I'm way in over already. But it is to say that very tellingly, and I had this really violent Battle of Italy game. I know, I can show you some other time. Anyway, just very tellingly, whoops, I'm going in the wrong direction. The World Cup ends up being kind of a disaster for Chile. And in part, none of the stadiums are filled. No one can afford to go. Chileans remember it as this wonderful thing. But the idea that somehow you should marginalize the most rabid fans, you know, those socialists don't really work out, doesn't really work out to the kind of glory of the game. And I'd like to add that Sebastian Piñera, do you know this president of Chile right now? So the dictatorship is going to do this harsh break, right? And here's a picture of someone who was from a prisoner's perspective in the National Stadium in 1973. And Professor Allegi already gave you a little background on Augusto Pinochet, where they use stadiums as camps. They also use local fields as places to round up people and torture people. So it's not just the National Stadium, it's also the stadium in San Miguel, which is very small, these fields where people play in what is today CAC, not really called San Miguel anymore, but there's a lot of different arrests that take place. And the symbolism is not lost on people who were protesting that. So the 1974 World Cup, you can see this a lot of kind of protest within football and it becoming a really part of the transnational solidarity movement. But just to tell you, Sebastian Piñera, this billionaire guy who's president now, he gave up almost all of his investments, but he wouldn't give up Colo-Colo, right? And so that's the one thing. And he said, and I think this is really ironic, and I'll just end with this, he says it's because it's not a political holding, right? So I'm just going to end with the kind of thought that, you know, a president could still own, you know, a great percentage of the most popular football team and kind of get away with it by using this argument that football is not, in fact, very political. So thank you for letting me go over, and I'm here.
Yeah, we have some time for questions, so
yeah.
We can open up to the floor now. Ask away.
I guess I'm curious, mostly because it relates to somewhat my own research interests, the issues of stadium constructions and how the government saw that as important for the national project and how it related to people on the ground who whose tax dollars or
yeah.
were actually going to pay for these and other like sort of land rights issues that went with you know, the construction of the stadiums themselves.
Yeah, in 1906, the sportsmen themselves, 1907, asked the government to build national stadiums, and they're just really not interested in doing it. There's not a lot of political will for it until the 1930s, very influenced by Germany. So they go to Berlin, the architect, which is Ricardo Müller Hess, and he copies what is it, the Olympic Stadium in Berlin. And so that is their kind of model. And in the process, there's a huge debate that takes place. Let me see if I can get you a picture. This is the non-modified stadium from 38. Now they have, you know, a lot of different additions to it. But there's a huge debate about, you know, you're going to use all Chilean labor, and it's actually the president, Alessandri's brother, who owns the land and who profits enormously. And then there's a lot of, and again, you're going to see this in Brazil, in South Africa. There's a lot of movement of people who live around the stadium. Even as late as the month before it opened, there were people whose houses had been evacuated by the police, who were re-going back to live there, who were evacuated again. So it becomes, really, it's reflective of the politics writ large, right, where you're willing to move people for social projects and the failure of the state to accommodate those people. They don't have any, I mean, they're really a disaster. They don't have any program whatsoever. I hope Brazil does. but they had no, they were just sort of like, you know, they'll find a place to go, and this is for the betterment of all. And again, about the issue of personalism, people get very angry. Football clubs lead the way in critiquing the president for using his brother's land, for profiting off of the labor in different ways, because he's also a member of the Banco Español and Inversiones in Chile, so he's somehow also profiting from the actual construction itself. And that becomes part of them saying, this is a white elephant, this is, you are trying to be a populist, you are trying to sell us. So it's actually a way in which they criticize populism rather than what you would think, which is for like the person who built the Berlin version, you would think it might actually mobilize into political capital. Instead, it doesn't. It becomes a political failure, in part because these clubs are very savvy as to where the money is coming from. They use their members who are workers who know whether they're using labor that's from unions or not. I mean, they're very, yeah. So it does affect the whole discussion on the ground about the clientelism of the administration. And he doesn't get elected. And the clubs actually have very big rallies for his opponents.
Okay. So you talk about how working class and elites, but particularly you focus on working class politicization through football clubs. And I guess my question is, when you started talking about the 1974 World Cup and the political kind of protests that were going on inside the stadium, right?
Sorry, because I breezed through that. This one was actually the one, that picture where there was the protest here was actually groups in Berlin at the 1974 World Cup, who were, I think it's Berlin, oh, it's West Germany.
Okay.
And they're protesting the Pinochet regime from there.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay, well my question is,
Munich? Is it Munich? I'm sorry, okay.
Is kind of, does football kind of politicize middle class as well? You talk about how the middle class goes into mm-hmm. professionalized, or so where does the middle class, I guess, fall in there?
Yeah, the construction of the idea of the middle class, too, is really important because in Chile there's this sense that somehow they're the buffer between the extremes of politics of the left and the right, and they really split even in the 1940s. So you'll see, like, the teachers, for example, and the teachers, different professional organizations that will join different workers, football associations, and you'll find others that are that are more linked to some of the military teams like badminton. But at the same time, the idea is very powerful that the middle class is supposed to be, you know, Christian Democrat, and they're part of this professional club still. So professional clubs, you may only have a team who's professional, right? But the club itself, thousands of people still belong to. And they're given their pricing, this is, it's very tricky for me to identify the actual class status of every single, you know, member, aggregate member, but given what I can determine from the pricing and from the people and the professions who are the leaders of a lot of those clubs, they would have been very middle-class clubs. Those immigrant teams, the Spanish, which is Unión Española, and Audax Italiano. And they're not just Spanish and Italian people, they're Chileans who join these clubs. And they're located in middle-class neighborhoods for a lot longer, whereas the wealthier clubs move way outside of the city early on, and the working class teams are all over.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, actually, like Jennifer, I have another class question. So I study elites, of course, Japanese elites in the U.S. Anyway, I'm curious to know how you went about building the case of the elites, you know, what their goals were, kind of like your methodology, sources, and whatnot.
Yeah.
And their reasoning for wanting. Okay. Yeah. Let's just start with that then.
Okay.
And then
so figuring out what they think.
Yeah.
They're
actually
kind of easiest.
Okay.
In the sense that they write more.
Right. That's what you do. Yeah.
So one of the easier things is like the Ramses, which are these early kind of Juan Ramsey. There's a club to him in Chile, and and they write all the time about first, like, I look through pamphlets, so I look through the Association of Referees, for example, and refereeing is a really British concept that they wanted the Chileans to learn to respect, and so that's one thing. They start the Association of Referees, and they always are publishing in, like, the Bulletin of Hygiene and the universities. So they've always got these articles about, you know, this is how we can help workers, and, you know, for example, we can help them by telling them to clean up their houses, you know, and that's help. And charity, they're huge parts of charity. A lot of times they're very frustrated with their lack of influence over teams. And you see that a lot in the National Federation. Now, I don't have good minutes because a lot of them were burned, but I do have different memorias, like different yearbooks. And so I can trace people. Like, for example, I'll know, like, a senator. Like, there's a couple senators that are very high ranking who are parts of different clubs, and I can see their activities within the football association, you know, here and there. And they write for these, they love, you know, because they love football. So they're willing, so you find them in these venues. But, for example, I brought, like, an estadios, right? So these, I don't know if you want to see it.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so I'll show you some of these. You can take a look. But the guy who edits it is a guy named Alejandro Jaramillo. And he's a very, like, elite sort of guy. And so he really arranges this more mainstream. Anyone can, yeah.
May I pass it around?
Yeah, pass it around. I have two. If you want to take a look. I think there's even a really salacious, awful cartoon. And this one that kind of proves my point about the kind of deep racism. I think it's in that one. But yeah, and so you know that this is the very, Estadio is identified as the very, you know, bastion of conservative sports. And it gets taken over. After Allende, they have a labor strike. And so when the socialists come to power in 1970, they take over Estadio. And it's very interesting to see how they try to change the magazine to build the new socialist sportsmen and women sometimes. So that's some. Did I answer that?
Yes, you did. Thank
okay.
You. Thank you.
Was there?
Yeah.
I was wondering a little bit on what Jennifer was talking about a little bit, but I wanted to return a little bit to the sort of question of needing to present yourself as apolitical. And this is always the sort of paradoxical situation in Chile where you have really intensely politicized polity, you have really well-developed kinds of political party identities. You have some political parties that, as you mentioned, kind of like the Christian Democrats, they sort of present themselves as sort of the apolitical middle and this kind of thing. But nonetheless, there's also this very important part, I think, of state making in Chile that says that, you know, the state really needs to take care of all of its citizens kind of equally without sort of looking at politics and this kind of questions. And I think that often reverberates then into the way in which citizens make claims that they also then need to present themselves in very apolitical ways. And if they're sort of too overtly political in the way that they step forward and ask for stadium space or access to neighborhood resources or even in union work, similar kind of thing where there's a kind of real push to show yourself as being apolitical. So I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit more about how that kind of tension between, you know, being sports team, which ostensibly could be something that's most defined as apolitical, and yet there's also all these sort of political activities going on inside, explicitly political activities. So I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit more about this tension between sort of the apolitical, sort of the need to make an apolitical claim, because that's entwined with the way in which sort of the justice of the state is spoken about.
And I think there's two, I think that's a great point in two ways. In the one sense, have I kind of politicized the footballers, right? And like, would they have thought in any way that that they're doing political work by being members of this team or something like that? So even I think that question bothered me in two ways. On the one, methodologically, it's a great question. I mean, it bothered me to myself methodologically thinking, how do you get away with saying this when most of these footballers would have said, what are you talking about? And did in interviews, you know, what are you talking about? And I went back to this kind of, that it links up with the other part of your question, that in fact it has to do with the ways in which it's always a struggle, the ways in which you define political space and what qualifies as political and what doesn't. And a lot of times what qualifies as political depends on who's doing it, right? So if you're white and powerful and male, it could be political or not as you want, right? And if you're a woman, it almost never is, right? So one of those tensions that's really interesting is the use of morality to apoliticize things. So that the dictatorship, and going back to the choice of Áñez, he wasn't doing anything political, he was doing something moral. Right? This is moral. So that they define everything that's left and changing as being political, and you know, these are just políticos, right? And we're trying to do something moral. And I think and I think that's a really important distinction in football, because I think they use it all the time to present their version of the world, which I argue is a really important one, because football is really an important way in which people have identified themselves and created these relationships. And the elites have managed to kind of frequently marginalize working class groups and organizations on that basis, right? You're just doing political work. You're just an arm of the Soviets, you know, and that's how you dismiss them. But we just do moral work. So our denial of your rights is for your benefit. It's you know, our moral obligation. It's not a political activity. So I mean, I think that's a really important and ongoing struggle throughout the 20th century.
Just a quick follow up on that. Is there how much does just playing football, being a part of a football club, then provide a certain kind of cover, whether or not people believe it to be apolitical or not. But how important is that to just be in that space of being a football club that actually then grants them a little bit more autonomy to move?
Absolutely.
As being sort of independent from, say, more politicized unions or political parties themselves.
Well, I think a lot. I mean, that's the central argument that I have. I don't know if you'll believe it if you read it. I know I've demonstrated it. Well, what I try to say in the book is it gives a lot of, on the basis of it's hard to say that footballers, it's still hard for them to make the argument that somehow, you know, they're arms of the Soviet Union. I mean, I do think they get way more leeway. They also are able to have more cross-political issues presented to the working class in a way, like they have candidates come to talk at the headquarters beginning in the 19-teens. And so it's also a way that makes them politically important. So on the one hand, it's just football, but on the other hand, now you've got a group of guys, and you know there's the electoral reform law that's already been through. You really need those guys all of a sudden, and you're willing to kind of come in person and maybe even talk to them. So it's two ways. I mean, on the one hand, they're able to, you know, make claims based on a less politicized set of interests, but on the other hand, they're also fully willing to use that in order to make political connections.
And you can also have, I guess, a right-wing billionaire today who, you know, a right-wing billionaire today who's the president, who is, also has this, you know, close connection to Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola, of course, though, is the team that's probably most associated with the working class and also probably has the most left-wing followers.
And that's what I'm hoping that my book, my book is scathing, if there's anything I hope it does, and I'm already trying to get it translated, if there's anything I hope it does, it's convince working class players it is not in your interest to root for this team, which has gouged state money, whose stadium was built by Pinochet, and who pushed professionalism and anti-workers policies from the beginning. But I haven't convinced anybody, not even my husband. Yeah. So I don't know how far I'm getting.
I knew that was, so it's okay.
Oh. Peter?
Yeah, good luck with that quest.
Yeah, right.
You didn't get much of a chance to talk about the 62 World Cup, so I want to go back to it. Because one of the interesting things in the book that you talk about is how the Chileans went about selling the bid.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
The bids back then were not the kind of, you know, ridiculously expensive and, you know, global marketing schemes that they are today. In fact, I'm curious as to when FIFA began alternating between South America and Europe, because it's not clear from what I've read. But anyway, race was one thing that the Chileans sold aggressively, right? That the idea that, look, you can give us the World Cup. Europeans, don't be scared that you're coming to South America, because we're a white nation. Right?
Yes.
And the other big asset that they seem to have been selling, Mr. Bitborns, was the patriarchal gender order of Chile is perfectly suited to the Europeans.
Yes.
And so my point here was this attack for selling the bid the result of kind of this elite conservatism that you had in Chile, or was it perhaps organizers playing to these European anxieties? FIFA was still dominated by European white conservative men. European anxieties and concerns about potentially giving Chile this premier world sporting event.
I think that it's what they try to do is anything. Well, first of all, it's important to understand they're competing against Argentina. So so their bid has to be, you know, about outdoing Argentina. And that wasn't really very difficult, because when it's decided in Lisbon in 1956, of course it's right after the coup that's going to lead Perón out, you know, that he's already fled, and this is, you know, it's in chaos, and there's a lot of political bad will already between Europe and Perón at that point, though hadn't always been. And so I think, you know, on the one hand, what they want to do is they want to use, and they do, in fact, use to sway Eastern Bloc countries. They point out the labor history of Chile and the unions, and they tell them, you know, all ideologies are welcome here. And to sway the West, they make this, they say, yeah, this is his quote, right? He says, this is Dipborn, who says, quote, Chile and its footballers, quote, have a considerable tolerance for creeds, races, and other ideologies. And I guess that's supposed to be communism. And then when it comes to Europe, yeah, they sell it on this kind of, we have really exotic women who are modern, but not feminist. Right? And they're really alluring. And the first line of the magazine is, you know, in the description of the country is Chile, you know, colon, white, the most homogenous country in the Americas. So there's no doubt that this is an effort to kind of ease their mind. At the same time, they would have defined Chile like that, even though there are Arab Chileans writing it, who are not defined by other Chileans as white. But they still probably would have bought into that. I think the elite kind of guys who are writing this, and even probably been born in the middle class, right? But I do think it's about wooing both those sides. So they do use that kind of lefty amateur tradition to convince Eastern Bloc countries. They're not above that, you know.
So yeah. Unfortunately, we have to leave the room because another book is grouped it. But all the graduate students, actually anyone that's interested in coming to another event we have tomorrow at noon, we're going to read one of Brenda's articles from the Journal of Social History and discuss it in a more small, intimate setting.
Third floor of Morrill?
Third floor of Morrill Hall, so 12 o'clock tomorrow. But thank you for coming, everyone, and thank you very much.
Tomorrow we're going to get the Battle of Italy, right?